Let me take this opportunity, since it is the last time that I will speak to you today, to thank the organisers who invited me to come, and to thank you too for the kind way in which you've received me. It is a testimony to the whole work of God in the hearts of people, that his people, when they meet together from diverse backgrounds, already belong to each other. I've been in parts of Africa and Asia where I understood but a few words that were spoken to me, and still I felt I was with family. And it is the great testimony that those who love the Lord Jesus and who are governed by his word have more in common across the denominations and across culture than people do with their own who are not in those categories. And I have enjoyed my time with you immensely. I have felt, if it is not a rude thing to say to you, totally at home. Friends of mine who are Australians and working in a missionary situation in Hong Kong said to their British friends, "You know, of course, that Australians are very informal people." To which they said, "How unfortunate for you." So please, when I say that I felt totally at home, it is meant to be a compliment, and I thank you for your kindness to me. Let me talk in this session about the minister and the congregation and their interacting role in that of evangelism. Whose work is the work of evangelism? Those of you who've spoken to me privately, and if you've read my book, which has everything I know about evangelism in it, which is very, very frustrating, isn't it? Has it ever occurred to you that you can write everything you know in 150 pages? I set out to write a second evangelistic book, and after I'd written two chapters and read it, it was the fresh start all over again. So I've written everything I know on that subject too. And somebody said to me, "When are we going to see your next book?" I said, "Everything I know is written down already." That's a bit of a shock to the system too, isn't it? There you go. Can't win them all. Whose work is it? Every Christian. Every Christian. And this is by lifestyle and by word. Now, I've already said those, and I don't want one without the other, and I don't want them to be set in opposition to each other. I want a lifestyle that commends the gospel and a gospel which explains the lifestyle. I want those two to be going hand in glove together. And I have spoken with you already about evangelism as a way of life. And I want to say that this will vary from person to person according to their skills and opportunities. If you'd like me to use the other word gifts, I'm happy to use it. But some people are socially skilled in a way which other people do not appear to be so socially skilled. Some people seem to make friends rapidly. Other people take a long time to do it. Some people don't seem to have difficulty articulating their thoughts. Other people seem not so adept at doing it. And some people are in situations where their circumstances of life reduce their evangelistic opportunities. Others of us are in positions where the evangelistic opportunities are being maximized. Now, I only say this to you because I want that to reflect in the way we encourage people in our congregation. Indeed, it seems to me to be the hardest part about training people for evangelism is to try and find a good expression for our people in the circumstances where they are, and that, in my judgment, cannot be done en masse. It has to be done with individuals according to their circumstances and according to their skills. My mother's mother died when she was 9. Her stepmother died when she was 11. From then onwards, my aunt and mother were farmed out to relatives, and because my auntie Vera behaved so badly, they never stayed anywhere for longer than 3 months. her crowning glory was that she said to one of her aunts, "I wish you were dead with my mother." And that gentle way that she had caused her not to endear herself to many relatives. My mother had attended 11 primary schools and had no further education, formal education. Consequently, she thought she was not an intelligent person because she was not schooled well. She was highly intelligent. She stopped going to Bible study because she was asked to read aloud, and that embarrassed her so much that she never went back again for 25 years. One of the ladies in our church said to her, "Muriel, why don't you come to Bible study?" She said, "Rose, I'm embarrassed lest I should be asked to read." She said, "Do come with me to that lovely one Mr. Deasy runs. You don't have to do anything there." My mother went back to Bible study and never missed until the day she died. I only say that to you to give you some indication of how little confidence she had. She got put into evangelism training class at the age of 74. I held the rector of her parish in the highest of esteem, that he thought that she could learn. And she said, "I've joined an evangelism training class, dear." I said, "Honest? That will be a revelation." I said, "You must teach me what is happening." She said, "Why don't you just mind your own business and let me get on with my own life?" Well, my mother, as she ever did put her hand to the plough, tended never to look back. She just ploughed ahead with the evangelism training course. And at the end of it, when she'd graduated, I said, "What are you doing now you've graduated from the evangelism training course, dear?" She said, "I visit 3 shut-ins." Well, I thought, well, that's clever, isn't it? Lawrence really does know what he's on about. I think the 3 she was allocated were on the basis she wouldn't do any damage if she didn't do any good. And I said, "Well, what do you actually do when you visit them?" She said, "I take a pot of jam and some flowers, and I say, 'I've come to have tea with you and to talk to you. I'm going to tell you about last Sunday's sermon because I know you missed it.'" I said, "Last Sunday's sermon?" I said, "Dear, you wouldn't remember it when you walked out the door." She said, "I write a few notes." I said, "Can I have a look at them?" She said, "Certainly not." I said, "Mum, can you honestly remember the sermon a week later? Honestly, can you?" Well, she said, "I often get muddled up, pet." I said, "What do you do then?" She said, "I think I'm muddled up now. I'll just say a little prayer and we'll have tea." Most of you know that I'm a bachelor, and I lived close enough to my mother to be able to give her aid, but not so close that we drove each other completely bonkers. And I used to often go on Saturday nights and have supper with her, and we watched television. Watching television is a misnomer, because on this particular night I woke up and both of us were sound asleep in front of the box. My father had made all of the furniture in our house, and it had kept us under chiropractors all our life. And I woke up and said to my mother, "For goodness sake, dear, go to bed. We've got good beds to sleep in, and here we are crippling ourselves in these awful chairs." She said, "It is a good idea, pet. I'm going to early church in the morning, 7:30. I said, "Whatever are you going to early church for?" She said, "There's a lady at the senior citizens I've met playing cards, Barbara, and I've asked her to come to church with me." And she said she would. I said, "What are you going at 7:30 for?" "Well," she said, "Ped, you know what it's like at 10 o'clock. It's full of children and babies, and once she sees the babies, she won't concentrate on the sermon. She'll be trying to work out how to get her arms on them and cuddle them all." I said, are you like that? She said, I've got to concentrate very hard not to be like it. So she said, at 7:30 there are no babies. I said, good thinking, 99. That's a good evangelistic strategy. Where will she hear the word best? I only hasten to point out to you, brothers and sisters, at that stage in my mother's life, it took her 2 hours in the morning to become mobile. So it is a 5:30 beginning. The year rolled on, and the next year rolled on. I said, how are you getting on with Barbara, pet? She said, she's coming. So that's for 2 years she had now gone to church at 7:30. I said, is she making any progress, do you think? Well, she said, we don't say all that much to each other. I just keep taking her along and she keeps listening. Vera thinks we oughtn't to sit with her. I said, what? Why? She said, well, pet, she swears most terribly. I said, who, Vera? I said, has she said anything you haven't already heard, Mum? She said, no. Well, I said, everybody at St. Paul's is like you, dear. If you've heard it, they've heard it. Tell Vera to sit on her own. I nursed my mother at home for a week and couldn't any longer, and she lived for another week in a nursing home. In the week that I nursed her, which is now 18 months down the track from the first mention of Barbara, the front doorbell rang. My mother lived in a flat which had an extended living room, a sitting room into a dining room, and an L shape, the kitchen came off it. So it didn't matter where you went in the house, your secret thoughts were revealed. It was so open. I opened the door and an elderly lady in a lemon linen tracksuit with long platinum Shirley Temple curls greeted me. She said, I'm Barbara. Well, I said, I'm John. And come on in. I said, I'll make some tea. And I went out into the kitchen, and as I remember, this is the conversation. How are you, dear? I think I am close to death, and that makes everything very urgent, Barbara. It is time you turn to Jesus. I don't have too much time to waste with you anymore, so why don't you bow your head and say this prayer after me? She said, what a good idea. Let's do it. And my mother led her in a prayer of confession and faith, and I brought out the tea. I only tell you the story because if you had told me that she was capable of doing it, I think I probably would have laughed. But Lawrence Lovell has gone right to the top of the ladder, so far as I'm concerned, because he persevered with somebody who was very unlikely, and he actually found a way that my mother could give expression to what she'd learned without feeling intimidated, and that brought her to a point where I thought she became quite good as a personal evangelist. I think I would have probably, with her gifts, written her off. But as I said before, if you love people, it is very difficult to hide. And it was perfectly apparent that that is what she had done. It is to me a constant rebuke and a reminder that pastoral responsibility means that in the area of training people for evangelism, I not only train them, but I help them to find a way in which they can give expression within the framework of their skills and their opportunities. I point out to you again that the minister is no less a minister, is no less a Christian, because he is a minister. In fact, if anything, he is more. I know that evangelists are full of their anecdotes, and I'll tell you another one. I was on holidays, and I went to the Greenpoint Baptist Church, for it had a name for being great. Several things were impressive about it. It had a very big and modern building. It had Siebel chairs bolted to cast iron fittings on the floor. Whose end they had measured as a norm, I have no idea, but I had the closest fellowship with the man I sat next to that I have with anybody. Our shoulder blades touched, and our ankles touched, and every part of my anatomy touched him. In fact, I was so embarrassed when I sat down the second time, I said to him, "You and I must stop meeting like this." The sermon was long and involved, and I thought inaccurate. They had a sharing time in the service. To this day, I've not been able to work out whether it was spontaneous or whether it had been organized. It looked as if it was spontaneous. The pastor simply said, "Are there members of the congregation who wish to share something with us?" And a man in his early 30s walked boldly to the lectern and said, "I have been witnessing to one of my friends at church, at work for several years. And I've asked him to come to lunch with me on Tuesday, and I think it is right to ask him why he has not decided for Christ. And I would be glad of your prayers." And he sat down. An entire family came, father, mother, steps and stairs, the whole tribe. He said, "Thank you for praying for us at the funeral that we were at this week. It was a hard time for us all, but we had good opportunity sharing the gospel with our family, and thank you for your prayers." And they all went back and sat down. A very elderly couple came, and he said, "Our neighbour is our age. She is totally careless about the things of God, and we are so concerned for her. And we have tried on many occasions to share the gospel, but she seems to be so hard, she won't even listen to us. And we covet your prayers for her." And they went and sat down, and he announced a hymn. Now, can I say to you, however that's been brought to pass, it is very impressive, is it not? If we have sharing time in our church, it tends to be so introspective. We're always on about somebody's carbuncles or the flu, really major things, earth-shattering things like that. And if I thought we had a sharing time in our church and 1 in 10 rose up and spoke about their desire to share the gospel and to ask the congregation to pray for them, even 1 in 10 would please me. But that they all did it makes me wonder if it was spontaneous. But it was very, very impressive. And that has only come about by very careful teaching and by a very godly example, wouldn't you think? If you had a sharing time and that was the full content of the sharing with your mob, would you think it would be so? It certainly wouldn't be with us. Our prayers seem to be terrifically introspective, and if you'll forgive me for saying so, often bordering on the trivia, which is to me fairly scary. I'm expecting everybody to be concerned about the gospel according to the food offered to idols principles, the all things to all men that by all means we might win some, and the 1 Peter 3:15, being ready to give a reason, always reverencing Christ in our heart as Lord, and being ready to give a reason to anyone who asks us for the hope that lies within us. That has led me to believe that everybody ought to be able to articulate the gospel. They ought to know the reason for the hope that lies within them. I want to ask you to think with me in Ephesians 4 on that great passage of God, the ascended Christ, showering his gifts down. And those gifts which the ascended Christ showers down, now the triumphant one who is able to share his booty, what are they? At 11, 4:11. And some are, it was that he gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, some to be pastors and teachers. What was the purpose of these? To prepare God's people for works of service, so that the body of Christ may be built up until we all reach unity of the faith, of the knowledge of the Son of God, and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of the fullness of Christ. Whatever the gifts are, they are all word gifts. And the purpose of the word gifts is to prepare God's people for works of service, for their ministry. And I want to suggest to you that not the least of that is that they are prepared for their work of evangelism, as well as other things in the Christian life. And whether I qualify as an evangelist, I found it very difficult to identify exactly what the evangelist does. We've got so little information, haven't we? We've got this passage, Timothy is told to do the work of an evangelist, and Philip is one. That's not much info to build a theology around, is it? And for the life of me, I can't work out whether it is somebody who does what I do, or that kid every time I go down to Bulleye, who for 5 years in a row, every year I went, had a couple of friends in tow, that he'd pull them up by the hand and he'd say, "Hey, Mr. Chapman, this is my friend Charles. He doesn't love Jesus. Tell him about Jesus." And then next time I'd go and there'd be a few more. Charles would be there with him, and Charles has got a few friends and he's got a few more friends, and they're all 3 inches higher and he's still on the same line. Well, I'm saying an outbreak of that in any congregation wouldn't do a scrap of harm, would it? I don't know what his gift is, but whatever it is, I'd ask for it to be repeated. Do you think, too, our great passion about looking at the present moment, the gifts, and trying desperately to identify them and see what I can work out what my gift is, might have led us up a blind alley? I think I ought to be looking at the end product of the gifts. What are the gifts for? That we'll all grow up together into Christ. The trouble with identifying your gifts all that too clearly is you have a tendency to think there's nothing else to be done. I go to St. Aidan's at Hurstville Grove. Just imagine I front up to my minister and say, "I think I've got the gift of teaching. Shove over." He says, "Shove back." Wouldn't it be monstrous if when I went, I thought, since I won't be teaching the Bible today, there's nothing for me to do here? I've got to be saying, what can I do to help this lot grow up into Christ? What can I do to be helpful here? What can I do that will allow people expression? And we may find, may we not, that we're multi-gifted. I actually find it difficult to put my finger on exactly what they were doing when I read the gifts. Not much information about them, do you think? Got more information about prophecy, and by the time I pore over that one, that 14th chapter of 1 Corinthians, I'm bothered if I know what they were doing. Sounds like preaching sometimes when I read it. I'm saying, well, that's the effect it has when I preach, and sometimes it sounds like it isn't. And I think if I can't identify that where I've got most information, I'm positive I don't know what helps are, but I think I probably enjoy it when people do it. I just don't know what they did that could be called help. I know any book on the gifts gives you a glossary at the back. Those very clever people seem to identify them at the drop of a hat. And I wonder if the reason why it is so obscure is because it doesn't matter. He's actually telling us the list of the gifts on every occasion so we'll be united. And to tell us there's diversity in this unity. And if we're not united, we won't have the diversity of the gifts operating. But since the list is different in every places, I wonder if they were different in the churches. And the idea that they had a certain gift in Corinth, therefore we ought to have it, does not seem to me to be a logical sequence. How do you know the same gift's got to be everywhere all the time? But these seem to me to be foundational. These word gifts seem to me to be crucial, so that people will be able to exercise their works of service and that we'll grow up together. Let me say something about the minister then as an evangelist himself. Have a look at the 2 Timothy 4 passage. I'm sure this, if it was not preached at your induction last time, there's a very good chance it will be. This is one of the purple passages in our part of the world for inductions, and I don't mind how often they preach on it. I think this sort of exhortation never goes astray. It's a very heavy exhortation, this one, isn't it? In the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, who will judge the living and the dead, and in view of his appearing and his kingdom. There's not too much more left to lay on you after he's laid all that on you, is there? You feel there's something quite big coming now? I should think so. In the presence of God, in the presence of Christ Jesus, may I remind you, he will judge you, who will judge the living and the dead, in view of his appearing and his kingdom. Preach the word. Be prepared in season and out of season. Does that mean when you feel like it and when you don't? Does it mean when things are going well and when things are going badly? Probably both. All the time, keep at it. Correct, rebuke, and encourage. Australians are very good at the first two. Very good at it. I think the Brits are better at the last one than they are at the other two. But we're very good at correcting. Very, very good at rebuking. Not much good on encouraging. It's a nice balance, that one, isn't it? Which, if you keep working your way through the scriptures, you'll do all. You'll do all. With great patience. And I would have thought he'd said, and much love, wouldn't you? If I'd written it, that's what I'd have written. That shows you how I don't think like God thinks. With great patience and careful instruction. For the time is coming when men will not put up with sound doctrine. Boy, it sounds like it was written yesterday, doesn't it? Instead, to suit their own desires, they will gather around them a great number of teachers to say what their itching ears wants to hear. They will turn their ears away from the truth and turn aside to myths. Dear brothers, can you imagine what this did to him when he read it? What will it do to you if it happens in your congregation? If they walk away from the truth, and they go to teachers where their itching ears will be filled with whatever they want to hear, and they will turn aside to myths. Here is the advice for us. Don't lose your nerve. Keep your head in all situations. Endure hardship. Do the work of the evangelist. Discharge all the duties of your ministry. Do you think we have taken seriously the fact that the New Testament is constantly telling us that there will be hardships in the ministry? Have you taken that on board and given serious cognizance of it? Hardships in ministry seems to me to be par for the course. They're always being told that it's going to happen. You've got to endure hardship like a good soldier and stick with it. The first 50 years are hard. Do the work of an evangelist. I want to say that if you and I don't evangelize from the pulpit, why will our people think we think it's important? They will not think it's important if we don't. If we're not clear tellers of the evangel when we preach. Now, that series of Martin Lloyd-Jones, the 52 sermons on Ephesians 1, when you get to 1:7, it is a marvellous evangelistic sermon. Mind you, very hard to preach on Ephesians 1:7 and not make it evangelistic, isn't it? I remember Dudley Ford, when he was the rector of Christ Church and Ives, inviting me to preach evangelistically for him. He said, "We're doing a series through the Apostles' Creed, John, and next Sunday we're preaching on I Believe in the Forgiveness of Sins." Very difficult to preach on that and not be evangelistic, isn't it? And I'm saying the way in which we preach will be a demonstration to people that this is a matter of urgency for us and for them. And can I say, I want to say again, that if I'm to do it in such a way that I'm the servant of Christ, I will be working on that to do the best I can. Not only the best in careful exegesis, but then to package it in the best possible way. So to this end, brothers, will you excuse me if I ask you some bold questions like, when did you last hear yourself preach? Let me say it again, in case it was never. When did you last listen to your sermon? Do you ever listen? I go once a quarter to a group of guys I taught at Moore College, all of whom are highly competent preachers. They spend a day once a quarter. Did I say a month? I meant a quarter. They listen to each other's sermons and they give each other feedback. And over the 3 years that we've done it, the improvement has been so good that I couldn't have believed it possible. They have turned themselves from good preachers, in my judgment, into great preachers. And they spend a lot of time working with each other as professionals, seeing how both their understanding of the Bible can be improved and their presentation of their preaching can be improved. If you don't ever listen to your sermons, let me say you're the only person in the world who earns their money by communicating who doesn't listen to the communication. There isn't anybody who communicates who doesn't listen to it. And the guys I teach at Moore College, what has been interesting to me, I teach all the second years, of course, in preaching. They preach sermons at the local church level. They bring them to me on tape. I listen to them, and we sit down and listen to the sermon together. Do you know that 90% of the things which would have made it better, they can put their finger on as we go through it? They say, "That isn't really very good there, is it?" I say, "No, it isn't all that good." I say, "Do you think you know how you could make it better?" Do you know, 9 times out of 10, they can make it better. They can do it. And so I want to say, when did you last listen to yours? Did you get any feedback? Can I say, those of you who have wives and whose wives give you feedback, remember, if they've been doing it for more than 5 years, they're only telling you if you were better or worse against your norm. And that norm mightn't have been good enough to start with, because they've got used to you, and so they're telling you it was worse than normal or better than normal. Okay? Are there elders who have permission from you to talk to you constructively about your work? I think you might find that helpful if you were able to get some feedback. Often the feedback we get with regard to our preaching is too kind. You may feel, you say, no, you don't know my mob. Okay? But I'm saying my experience is that people love their pastors with good cause, and they want to encourage them. And they don't quite know how to say when they would like to correct it, and often they don't know how to correct it. But I'm saying, I think you would do it. Have a listen to your own. My experience has been, if I listen to my own preaching, after I've preached, if I listen, say, to a tape in the afternoon, I've preached in the morning, I think it's brilliant. It's crystal clear. It's exactly what I wanted to say. If I put away and listen to it a week later, it's never as clear as I thought it was. That just means I'm too close to it then. Can I say, as an evangelist, will you work hard at preaching and work hard at preaching the gospel? The congregation ought to know that it really does matter. Can I talk about the minister as the playing coach? People grow like their ministers. Do you know that? It's weird, in a way. My theory is this. When the minister stops reading the Bible, the people stop reading the Bible. When he starts, they start again. When he stops saying his prayers, they stop saying, I don't know how they know. I think what happens, we're unconscious in conversation. Flag certain things that we're not even conscious we've done. And they pick up the vibes. And more by modelling than anything else, in the work of evangelism, do people see the model, hear about the model, and start to copy the model. Many years ago, I read a book by Walter Chantery. You may have picked it up. Today's Gospel, Authentic or Synthetic. I was much impressed by Walter Chantery's book, mainly because he was the first truly reformed person I'd read who seemed to me to be interested in doing evangelism. All the reformed people in our part of the world were so sure that God was going to do it that they decided he wasn't going to do it through them. And everybody who was doing it thought that if they didn't do it, God wouldn't be able to do it. And suddenly, in the middle of this, came Walter Chantery. And I thought, well, this is a great thing. I wrote and said to him how much I'd enjoyed reading his book. And when I came to the States, could I visit him? And he said, don't visit me. I only write about it. Visit these two guys. They do it. So I visited them. And since some of you might know them, I will not disclose their names. I went to one of them. And the church seemed to me to be very interesting indeed. They were doing door-to-door visiting where they needed to get police protection in that part of the States. Can I say that if I needed police protection, that would be guidance for me not to do it? Would you need any clearer guidance than that? I mean, if an angel from heaven came and said otherwise, it wouldn't make much difference with me. I was very impressed with the men and women in that congregation. They seemed to be red hot for the gospel. And I said to their pastor, do you think all people ought to do the work of evangelism? He said, certainly not, only those with the gifts. I said, do you think you ought to train them? He said, no, if they've got the gifts, God will throw them up, and you don't need to give training. I went down to Philadelphia a week later. I said to the pastor of that church, do you think all Christians ought to preach the gospel? He said, of course they ought. I said, do you think you ought to train them? He said, I certainly wouldn't ask them to do it if I hadn't trained them. Do you know what? I couldn't detect any difference between the congregations. I reckon you could have picked the pastors up and swapped them. And the factor which seemed to me to be the most important factor of all was that both of them themselves were doing it. Both of them were known by the congregation as men who were concerned to spread the gospel not only publicly but privately. And they had picked it up from then. I want to urge you not to ask the congregation to do that which is not done by you. And so it brings me now to my third point, which is that the minister as a trainer. And I've said that in the training of people, I don't want to bore you by going over this ad infinitum, but godliness is at the top of the priority and that people ought to know it. A gospel outline, some basic apologetics, and pastoral care in the way you encourage people to exercise their gifts. Try not to plough them into situations where they are incapable of handling it. Every time people get discouraged in evangelism, it's so hard to get them up again. I try to be pastorally responsible. I had a Bible study, the Bible exposition group on a weekly basis that used to meet in downtown Sydney. I was trying to reproduce St. Helens Bishopsgate. They were getting 600, I was getting 60. I think that might say something about the relative teachers, but I won't go into it. But in this, from time to time, in this group of guys and women who met together, we used to do evangelism. I remember on the first occasion, I urged them with such ferocity to bring their friends that those who couldn't get friends stayed away because their guilt factor was so high. And instead of having 60, we had 23. A pastor like me, they need like a hole in the head. And I learnt by bitter experience that I should have encouraged them to be there for the fun, even if they couldn't get a friend, and that asking people to come was the name of the game. They're not responsible for the decision making of their friends, either to come or not to come. And I want to say that as a trainer, whatever happens, see that you're pastorally responsible so that you don't place people in situations where they've got no gifts or abilities for it. And in our great endeavour to try and encourage them, be gentle, knowing what you yourself are like. That's the nice part about our high priest, isn't it? He knows exactly what it is like. And that is why he himself is gentle with us. Can I just say too, when it comes to evangelistic things, you have got lots of people on the list that you want to invite. When you sit at the other end of the pulpit and you are in the pews, we generally don't have a lot of people on our list. My rector on one occasion said, "Oh, by the way, and next week I'll be preaching evangelistically." I thought, well, he really has got no idea of the sinfulness of my heart. I need more than a week. I need at least a week to start praying that I'll be obedient. And then who will I look for? And a week is not time enough for my friends. They live very busy lives. The guys at the golf club I only see on Wednesday. I got to issue an invitation to them on Wednesday for next Sunday. They'd laugh at me. I wouldn't even try that. I need a lot of time and I need a lot of encouragement. And that is why I urge you again for prayer triplets. In the time that's left before I finish, I want to talk about fear that most people have and that we need to teach and help people in this matter of fear. I am frightened that you will reject me. I am frightened that unbelievers will reject me. My fear with the unbelievers is well grounded. They often do. Not always, but sometimes they do. What is unpleasant about being rejected? Has it not got to do with our sense of value? But my value, if it's grounded in the gospel, does not really depend on your recognizing of it, does it? Am I not valuable because God has set his love upon me in Christ? I mean, if as a body you all stood up and stamped out, I mean, it would give me a bit of a shock. But am I not equally valuable if that happened as I was before it happened? Does my value not come? My worth comes in another quarter. If you recognize that I'm a valuable person because Christ has died for me and God has set his love upon me in Christ, yeah, that will confirm it to me. That will be a terrific confirmation. And if you continue to recognize me as a person of worth because of that, But if value comes because of acceptance, or as I suspect with most of our people, because of their work, what happens if your value comes with work and you're unemployed? What happens if your worth comes through work and you're struck down? Do you cease to be valuable? No, it's just harder to believe it. And that is why we've got to teach people to be able to minister the gospel to themselves if they are rejected. My fears are often illogical at this point because I think everybody does not want to hear. I think nobody wants to hear. Nobody will listen. Nobody will believe. But those things are dredged up from the pit, I think. Do you think you can smell the sulphur fumes over those ideas? Can I tell you the things which assault me most as an evangelist? Listen to the logic of this. I arrive in a place where everybody is unknown to me. Got that piece of information? I'm a perfect stranger. Do you know the first thing I say as I mount the pulpit? There are no unbelievers here. You can tell by looking at them. Is that not unbelievable? I don't know a single soul in the building. I can see, you can tell by their suits, they're all believers. Or something else. And you know what? That trick is played again and again and again. I say, there must be unbelievers, brother, or you wouldn't be tempted to think there aren't. Go for them. So I look around, I look at the most unbelieving face I can see. And I think to myself, it's you, mate, I'm going for. And in my mind's eye, I keep thinking about him. You know, 9 times out of 10, he turns out to be a lovely Christian who's got a pew full of relatives in tow. You know the next thing? I'm in full flight. And I think to myself, nobody will believe this. They'll think you're a complete Charlie. You hardly believe it yourself. So I think that must be an important bit. I'll say that again. So I just backtrack on that sentence and stay with it again. Now, there is only one source that comes from. That has got the sulphur fumes all over it. That's dredged straight up from the pit. Whether there are believers or unbelievers, I ought to tell them the gospel. Won't it be better if they go home saying, gee, if I'd known he was going to be like that, I'd have brought my brother? Isn't that the best thing that can happen? Will the gospel not strengthen the hearts of all the believers who are there? You tired of hearing the gospel? You are sick then. You are sick. Or maybe it's not being preached. By the time I get to the end, I think, boy, yes, I do believe that. The more I preach the gospel, the more I'm sure it's true. I think there's only one source that comes from. That has got the sulphur fumes all over it. That's dredged straight up from the pit. Whether there are believers or unbelievers, I ought to tell them the gospel. Won't it be better if they go home saying, gee, if I'd known he was going to be like that, I'd have brought my brother. Isn't that the best thing that can happen? Will the gospel not strengthen the hearts of all the believers who are there? You tired of hearing the gospel? You are sick then. You are sick. Or maybe it's not being preached. By the time I get to the end, I think, boy, yes, I do believe that. The more I preach the gospel, the more I'm sure it's true. I think, gee, well, even I'd get converted again if I heard that. There is a converted Hindu called V.J. Menon, who is a member of the congregation at St. Helens. I don't doubt he does it to everybody, but it's a great boost to me. He rushes up to me at the end. He says, oh, dear chap, I just want to say to you, as a Hindu, I got converted 3 times all over again. You keep that up, chapo. You keep that up. The minister as the trainer and the minister as the great encourager. Let me say one or two things before I conclude, because it is nearly 12:30. I want to say, with regard to loving people, is church user friendly? That'd be a nice thing. Is it user friendly when people come? And can I just say, the new converts are a big help to us, aren't they? Because they're like all new members of the families, they have a tendency to change the family. And they often see things. I remember a friend of mine I took to church, and when we arrived, he was totally unchurched. Totally unchurched. He could never remember ever going, ever, ever, ever. And I thought I'd really filled him in quite well for the occasion. And when our guys walked in their togs, he burst out laughing. And he said, "Are they for real, Chapo?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "They dress up like that all the time." I said, "No, only at church." He said, "What they do that for?" I said, "They're basically galahs, mate. Don't worry about it." Do you know what a galah is? A galah is a bird in Australia. It's like a parrot. And it's got a brain about the size of my fingernail. And the rudest thing you can say to an Australian is, "Don't be a galah, mate." It means brainless to the end. I thought about everything. I forgot to tell him about the togs. He was totally, and I thought to myself, they are stupid things, aren't they? When I looked at this pair walking up the aisle, I thought, dear God, could you give him short-sightedness quickly? I remember reading a lovely article that Claire Smith wrote recently about the first day she took a little boy to school. She said, "I had done everything I thought that needed to have been done. She said, I walked with him to school so he would know the way. I showed him where the toilet was so he'd have no trouble finding it when he needed it. I told him where to sit to have his lunch. I kept rehearsing the name of his teacher with him so he would know her name. He said, when he came home," she said, "I realised that I'd neglected to prepare him for the most important thing of all. He said, do you know the boy who sits next to me doesn't even believe that Jesus lived? Aged 5. She said, "I had sent this little soldier off to fight all on his own, and I hadn't even warned him that there was a warfare to be engaged in. But," she said, "he seems to be holding his end up pretty well, even though his mother forgot to prepare him about the most important thing of all." Can I say, when church is going on, is it user-friendly? Is there some way you could make it just for the regulars to be more user-friendly? And don't tell me there's a fine line with compromise. That's not going to be your problem. Trust me, it won't be our problem at that. Of course there is. I don't want you to be like the 9 o'clock show, and I don't want you to end up like the 9 o'clock show. But the chance of that happening is 1 in 50 zillion, isn't it? If that happens, it'll be a terrific surprise to me. It'll make the raising of Lazarus look like peanuts. When the new people come, get them to tell you how they felt on the first day. And then ask the question, is that essential for us, or could that change? And the teaching of people to be adaptable for change is really hard. And that's part of our work too, isn't it? I've said to the people at St Aidan's where I am, do you think we could make as a goal that each one of us would try and lead somebody to Christ this year? Does that seem to you to be impossible? They love that idea. Do you know, if it happened, they'd hate it? Because if we all led somebody to Christ in the year, it'd double our congregation. Do you know what would happen if our congregation doubled? They mightn't get elected. there'd be enough voters to outvote them. And if we doubled our congregation in a year, odds on, if you didn't get there early, you wouldn't be able to sit in your place. And on it would go. It's very hard to teach people that if we are going to increase, change and adaptability are there. And I just want to say, at my age, I find that increasingly difficult to do. While thinking about myself as a radical, I discover I've become very staid. I like things to be the way I like them. I like not to have to learn new tricks. You know that marvellous cartoon of Larson? They're at a circus. There are many people watching. The dog is on a unicycle on a tight wire high above. He is juggling oranges and plates on the unicycle, and between his teeth he has a little puppy, and underneath it said, "High above the hushed crowd, Roger was concerned. He was an old dog, and this was a new trick." Okay. I think both by public and private, the minister is, as trainer and playing coach, plays a crucial role in the work of evangelism. And for pastoral responsibility, together with exhortation, I think are a powerful combination. Can I take the opportunity again to say thank you for having me as your guest over the week? It's been a great time and I've loved it. Do you want me to...